Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Warp Speed by Travis S. Taylor. Narrated by Brian Holden. Chapter 1. I was trying hard to breathe, but it wasn't coming easy. I tugged at my red team uniform top anxiously. Smacking my fist against my headgear was the only thing that seemed to focus me.
"All right, bow to me," the referee began. "Bow to each other. Touch gloves. Fight."
Seeing that my opponent was dropping his hand back, I slipped to the right. I lunged like a sprinter out of a starting block and jumped. As I prepared to backfist the guy on the side of his headgear, I realized that I had let my elbows rise and I was not covering my ribs. I knew this because I presently spit my mouthpiece in my opponent's face while at the same time a searing pain ran through my ribs on the right side of my body. You see, I fight right side forward since my right leg is more flexible than my left. Not that it mattered this time since I failed to lead with a kick. I heard the shouts and cheers for the other guy increase in volume and enthusiasm while I fell to the floor, clutching my ribs. That's just the way it is on the International Sport Karate Association, or ISKA, tournament circuit. The referee was talking to my opponent. "Turn and bow," then in my ear. "Do you want your sensei or will you make it?" He handed me a slightly dirty mouthpiece.
"Nah, I'll make it okay."
I blew dirt off the mouthpiece and noticed my instructor shouting at me as I made it to my feet.
"What's that rainbow jump crap? I never taught you that. Let's go, Anson. 1, 2, 3, white belt stuff. Stay tight."
He yelled and ticked off his fingers, 1, 2, 3, at me. I bounced back to the line with each breath burning like fire in my side. Two ribs were broken at the least. I was sure of it. But if I had any intentions of staying in this fight, I knew that I had better not show a soft spot. Mike and I have been friends for years, and I'm sure he didn't mean to break my ribs, but he was here to win this tournament just like I was, and we were tied in points for ISKA champion. This fight was going to be a tough one. The last fight of the season should be a tough one, I guess, especially if it's for the championship.
"Are you ready?"
the ref asked. I nodded and lined up left side forward this time, my right side being soft.
"Judge's call. I got 2 points. Blue uniform."
With a look around the ring at the other two judges, it was obvious that I was behind 2 points.
"Okay. Touch gloves. Fight."
Just like in class with the instructor yelling, I could hear in my mind, skip side kick, back fist, reverse punch.
1, 2, 3, I got him. "Break," yelled the center ref. "Judge's call."
He held up 2 fingers in my direction and scanned the other 2 judges.
"That is 2 red, 2 blue. Touch gloves. Ready? Fight."
Skip side kick, back fist, reverse punch. This time it didn't work as well. Mike sidestepped and down-blocked the skip kick. But that is why it goes 1, 2, 3, or skip side kick, back fist, reverse punch. The skip kick occupied his lead hand with a down block, leaving his head open for the back fist and his chest open for the reverse punch. Of course, I caught one to the body in there somewhere, but I was first, and that's what counts in sport karate.
"Break. Judge's call? Okay, we have 3 red, 2 blue. Ready?"
"Time, ref," I called and motioned to my foot gear as though it were loose.
"Time, red."
I knelt and acted like I was fixing an equipment problem. My ribs ached, and the second of extra breathing time helped.
"Let's go, Red."
I bounced up like a rubber ball and nodded to the ref. I was thinking I couldn't take another second of this. A punch would mean 1 point. Not enough, and I knew I wasn't going to make it much longer. I was starting to feel queasy, but I lined up right side forward. Just a chance I would have to take.
"Ready? Fight."
This time I was too slow. Mike rushed me with a barrage of hand movements. He is a Kenpo student, after all, mostly hands. I slipped to the right and pulled my knee up and proceeded with a side kick. To my surprise, Mike did the same thing. Fortunately, or not so fortunately, I'm not sure, I'm more flexible. My foot got higher than his, and as a result, his foot slid down the side of my leg and caught my cup with full force. I did the only thing I could do to defend against such an attack. I fell to the floor, holding my crotch.
"Break. Blue, turn and bow."
"Where'd he get you?" The ref tapped my headgear to get my attention. I heaved twice and rolled over to my hands and knees. I heaved again. Lucky for me, I hadn't eaten anything yet, so nothing came up. I realized then the heaving seemed to hurt my right side, my ribs. Funny how getting kicked in the jimmy will make one forget how bad other things hurt. I'm not sure how, but I made it to my feet again. I wiped the sweat from my forehead, which was pouring profusely out from under my headgear and down my face as I lined up left side forward this time. I smiled at Mike, and I put my mouthpiece back in. I had him right where he wanted me. "Sorry, man, you okay?" He seemed legitimately concerned. The center ref called attention, and then, "That is a warning blue for low kicks. Ready?" We both nodded and touched gloves. "We still have 3 red, 2 blue. Fight!" The ref dropped his hand and stepped back out of our way. I was right. I did have Mike right where he wanted me. Like a freight train, all 230 pounds of him came barreling right for me. I knew just what to do. I ran for my life. Without thinking, I turned my back and began to run. Somehow I jumped while facing him and threw a right leg, spinning back kick. This was a survival technique only. I don't recommend it as a standard technique. My right foot caught him off guard right in the gut. Luck counts in horseshoes and hand grenades, in nuclear war, and sometimes at the ISCA championships. "Break! Judges call! I got 2 red. That is 5 red. I heard my instructor yelling something, but he seemed too far away and seemed to be getting further and further away. Then there was no longer any light at the end of the tunnel. The next thing I knew, I was back home in my study looking at my whiteboard. There were tensor equations scribbled all over it. In the middle was an equation written explaining that space-time curvature is proportional to energy per volume, which is proportional to mass times the speed of light squared divided by volume, which is proportional to electricity and magnetism divided by volume. I had been writing this equation in various ways since undergraduate school and never could figure out how to change the proportionality symbols to equal signs. Nobody could. Einstein died trying, as have many others. The equation is a very simple explanation of the holy grail of physics. Einstein's general relativity, or GR, states that space and time, or space-time, is curved due to energy. Energy and mass are interchangeable just by multiplying by the speed of light squared, c squared. So, the curvature of space-time is proportional to the speed of light, in a way. Also, electricity and magnetism are forms of energy somehow. Electromagnetic forces are most likely the cause of matter having form, and in some way, the cause of gravity, where gravity is the curvature, sort of. The equation means that the space-time is curved due to the amount of energy in a given volume, or that a given curved space-time causes a certain energy per volume. Each of these phenomena causes the other, and this energy per volume can exist in many forms. There was something else on the whiteboard that really caught my attention. On the bottom right-hand corner of the board was the equation explaining that space-time curvature is defined as the square root of stuff times electricity and magnetism divided by volume. Of course, both of these equations were written in the Einstein tensor notation, so they really didn't look like this. The actual equations take nothing short of years in graduate school, sweating over tensor mathematics and things called Ricci tensors, stress energy tensors, space-time metrics, and the cosmological constant just to be able to read. Understanding them takes even longer. But this is the general idea of what my lucidly dreamt whiteboard stated. Most importantly was that the proportionality symbol was changed not only to an equal sign, but a defined as sign, meaning that the equation was a fundamental equation describing the universe. After this equation was one that stated that stuff is defined as being equal to... "Anson, can you hear me?" Both my instructors were yelling in my face and shaking me, and I smelled something god-awful as I startled to consciousness. "What happened?" I jumped up and felt a searing pain in my right side. "Easy." Someone that I can only assume was the tournament paramedic started shining a light in my eyes. "Can you hear me?" "Yeah, I'm fine. Let me up."
"Hold still, Anson, and let him check you out," one of my instructors said.
My instructors are a husband and wife team. She is usually more verbally sympathetic. I didn't care what the medic did. My mind was still swimming with the tensor math on the whiteboard in my dream, and I wanted to read it more closely. I smelled that awful smell again and startled completely too this time.
Okay, I'm awake.
Where are you hurt? The medic asked. I have at least 2 broken ribs on my right side, maybe more. Did I win? The husband member of my instructor duo laughed.
You got him with the ugliest spinning back kick I have ever seen in my life, but you won.
Cool, help me up. I rolled up very slowly. The crowd cheered. I'm going to change. Could somebody pick up my award and then drive me to the nearest emergency room? I didn't expect that a doctor could do anything for me other than prescribe some good painkillers. Doctors, or as I prefer to call them, physicians, databases, quacks, etc., haven't cured anything. Not one damn thing since polio, which was way before I was born. Come to think of it, they didn't even come up with a cure for that. They simply committed something akin to genocide on the polio virus. I'm not completely sure why the quacks haven't gotten anywhere over the last 60 years, though it's probably because they don't have to take enough physics and math in school. A physician depends on the miracle of the human body's ability to heal and adapt. Any good physicist or engineer will tell you, if you have a broken support strut, a bone, you either weld that damn thing back together or you replace it. You sure don't sit around and wait for it to fix itself in 6 weeks or so. The way quacks deal with a more serious illness is nothing short of magic or alchemy. Whatever it is, it sure isn't science. My magic book says that if you look this way, smell that way, and have stuff coming out of your nose, then you should take 2 of these pills a day for 10 days while standing on 1 foot and praying to Hippocrates. If you don't get better in 2 weeks, then come see me again. That'll be $1,000, please. No way that's science. The guy who invented the pill may be a scientist, but not the guy administering it. An example of the physician's incompetence is aging. Why we still grow old and die is beyond me. All of us are infected with a genetic disorder that causes our genes to break down and start producing old cells, or cells that are mutated to create the symptoms of old age. This process is either caused by cosmic rays, ultraviolet rays, or other radiation exposure, or maybe some chemical mishap within our own bodies. Maybe it is a statistics problem. But whatever the cause, it is a disease we're all born with. Physicians accept this as a natural thing because they simply won't do their homework and solve the problem. Fix the damn broken genes or replace them. The local university quit letting me teach the beginner-level physics classes the pre-med and business students take. The student evaluations claimed I was too hard and assigned too much homework. You get the idea. If the first American in space were still alive today, old age got him. You could ask him if he would have wanted to be on top of several tons of ignited explosives that guys who complained about too much homework designed. Maybe I'm cynical, because I have had broken bones before. Jim Daniels, one of my teammates and best friend and student and teacher, all in one, got my stuff together while I changed clothes. I still couldn't shake the weird punch-drunk dream that I had. I mentioned it to Jim a time or two, I think. I was still a little shaky. I had to have help getting my shirt over my head. I wished I'd brought a button-up instead of the pullover. Next, we went to the hospital, then back to the hotel, though I still don't remember a major portion of the transition. I do remember one part of the hospital visit that reaffirmed my position on physicians. When it was all over, the wizard at the emergency room said, "There isn't really anything we can do for broken ribs. You just have to keep them immobile and let them heal on their own. It should take about 6 weeks. I'll write you a script for the pain." What a surprise. Fortunately, my insurance covers emergency room visits. Hell, man, I knew all that. Why'd I need you? Oh, yeah, I remember now. You bastards have it lobbied so that you think you're the only people in this country smart enough to administer pain medication. I wish you were in my physics class, you... I get irate when I'm in serious pain and dealing with quacks. "Anson, calm down!" Jim grabbed me and put a nerve hold on me that hurt worse than my ribs. That was his way of telling me to either shut up or he would shut me up. Did I mention that Jim was my friend? Unfortunately, my insurance only covered about $20 of the prescription painkillers that cost $200. I have some vague memories of speaking very harshly to a short Pakistani pharmacist at an all-night drugstore. Jim has since assured me that the poor pharmacist didn't deserve any of the tongue-lashing. Like I said, I get irate with the whole medical industry in this country. It is an industry, not an art, or a merciful charity, or a scientific profession. Hell, it's not even magic, for that matter. By the time I got back to the hotel, the painkillers were working great. I was so loopy, I would never have made it into the room by myself. It seemed like the next thing I knew, my alarm was buzzing at me. I hit it, and it stopped. Then the phone rang. It was my wake-up call. I forced myself up and took a shower. Jim must have helped me pack, although I have no recollection of that. I got dressed very slowly, trying to withstand the pain. After a short while, I became more awake and less under the influence of the painkillers that I had taken the night before. My mind was clearing, but there was still a dull ache in my side, and any sudden movement nearly killed me. Once, I sneezed, and I thought I was going to die, it hurt so badly. I got a cab to the airport, but unfortunately I wasn't going home. I had a conference on the progress of the Breakthrough Physics Propulsion Program to attend at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center the next day. I was looking forward to the conference before I broke my ribs. Thank goodness I had enough air miles built up to upgrade to first class. Coach seats would not have been fun. Chapter 2. Normally I don't drink on airplanes. It dehydrates me and the air in commercial aircraft is dry enough as it is. But this was an exceptional circumstance. My ribs hurt, and I was in first class where drinks are free. I figured a couple drinks couldn't hurt and might even help dull the ache in my side. I was on my second domestic beer before the coach section was boarding. I watched the sky marshal eye the coach passengers as they filtered past him at the entrance of the plane. I think he realized that I figured out what he was doing, and he quit making eye contact with me. After a few minutes of that, boredom set in, so I began flipping through my slideshow on my laptop for my talk the next day. I just couldn't get in the mood, so instead I pulled up a game of chess I'd been playing the computer for about a week. I'd lost the game about 50 times, so I kept undoing the game back to when I was in the lead and starting over from there. Needless to say, I'm not that good at chess. I was on about my third beer when it looked like the plane was going to be closed up and I would have an empty seat next to me. Then, at the absolute last second, a woman in a U.S. Air Force uniform came through the hatch, made her way to the seat beside me, put her bag away, and sat down next to me. Her rank appeared to be light colonel. She looked very familiar, also. Once she was settled in her seat, she finally gave me the cordial hello that you give the person sitting next to you in an airplane. I returned the hello and went back to my beer and chess game. The flight attendant wandered by and asked if I needed anything, and told me that I had to turn off my computer for departure. I closed the laptop and replied that I could use another drink. Like I said, I never drink while flying. By the time we leveled off at 28,000 feet out of Louisville, it was time to find the lavatory. The captain didn't turn off the seatbelt light a second too soon. I slowly made it up and by the colonel and found the restroom. If you ever try to use a bathroom on a commercial aircraft, I suggest that you don't do it with two broken and three separated ribs. Each tiny pocket of turbulence I could feel travel up through my leg bones into my torso and finally my ribs. The four beers didn't help either. I finally gathered my wits and felt my way back to my seat. This time I noticed the wings on the colonel's shoulder and realized where I'd seen her before. She looked different, with her red hair in a ponytail rather than floating around her on the International Space Station, the ISS. She was an astronaut, and I had seen her on television. In fact, according to the show I'd seen, she had more space hours than any other female astronaut in history. I said excuse me to her as I sat down, and got myself settled and then pressed the service button. When the flight attendant returned, I asked for my fifth beer. Just as she turned to leave, I sneezed. If you have ever had broken ribs, you know this is not a good thing to do. I think I already mentioned that.
Oh, shit!
I clutched my side and swallowed back tears. Are you okay? The colonel asked.
Yeah. I got a couple busted ribs and that sneeze hurt.
The pain began to dissipate and hopefully so did the grimace on my face.
I see, she said. This may seem a little strange, but you look familiar to me.
I laughed and clutched my side. That's funny. I was thinking the same thing. You are Colonel Ames, right? The female astronaut with the most hours in space? She smiled and presented her right hand. Tabitha Ames, it's nice to meet you. I reciprocated with, Neil Anson Clemens, friends call me Anson.
I thought I recognized you, she said. Didn't you give the talk on the modified Alcubierre warp drive at the Advanced Propulsion Workshop at NASA Marshall Space Flight Center last summer?
Well, I replied. There were about 4 or 5 talks on warp theory last year, but I did give one of them. Are you going to the breakthrough physics thing?
Yes. In fact, I'll probably be a lot more involved with that program in the future, she said and looked at me speculatively.
I had no idea what she meant by that. I didn't really care since the attendant finally returned with my beer. Colonel Ames surprised me and asked for one, too. Can you drink on duty? I asked.
Who says I'm on duty? She retorted in a mind-your-own-business way.
Oh, I said, as if I'd been scolded. I'm not sure what it was, but Colonel Ames has this air about her that she's the boss no matter who's in the room. The simple inflections in her voice are enough to make you feel good or bad. It just depends how she means it. Some people have this talent. Myself, I just trip and fumble over my heavy North Alabama accent and hope people at least understand what I'm trying to say. Then I usually throw in a, well, hell far, I just made all that shit up, it's probably all wrong, just to cover my ass. For some reason, people believe if you talk with a southern accent, you're an idiot. Let them keep thinking that. With both feet in my mouth, I asked, don't you astronauts usually fly trainers wherever you're going?
I have too many hours this week, so it was either second seat or commercial, she replied.
I see. You know, I have put in an astronaut application each open time since 1999, and never once even got an interview. What's the trick? I asked, jokingly.
Well, for a mission specialist, I guess the trick is to come up with an experiment that has to be done in space that only you can do.
She pursed her lips as if in thought, then replied,
You've only been trying for 10 years?
I nodded, yes.
Don't give up.
She smiled at me, and I felt like I could do anything. Some people just have the ability to inspire confidence. Colonel Ames definitely inspired something in me.
If I may ask, why and for how long have you been so interested in spaceflight anyway?
She smiled and shrugged at me. Don't mind you asking at all. I don't really know a date exactly, but it is all I've ever wanted to do. My mom tells me it is because I'm destined to it, I replied.
Destined to it? Colonel Ames asked.
Oh, yeah, that's a neat story. You see, I was born at the exact instant that the lunar excursion module of Apollo 11 touched down on the moon. I'm certain thousands, heck, maybe more babies were born at that instant, but it must be destiny, according to Mom. You know how mothers can be, I explained and kind of laughed. She just nodded, as if she understood. Then the plane rocked swiftly from turbulence, and I grimaced in pain and held my side. She noticed.
If you don't mind my asking, how'd you hurt yourself?
She seemed sincere and looked concerned. Then is when I realized her eyes were brown. I think that's common for redheads. Or is it green? Well, I was in the International Sport Karate Association Championship yesterday. I left my right elbow up when it should have been down. I made a motion like a right back fist showing how it leaves your ribs open, and I placed my left hand on my right side. I caught a side kick full bore right here. I still won, though. I couldn't tell if she was impressed or not.
So you do karate to stay fit? She asked.
Yeah, also a lot of mountain biking and some running, but my favorite is karate, I replied. If I ever do get accepted into the astronaut program, I still have to meet the fitness requirements.
Good, you have the right attitude, she said. I do a lot of running and swimming and a little aerobic kickboxing. A lot of astronauts that I know are into karate and a lot are into cycling. Whatever works best for you.
The remainder of the flight consisted of small talk and my fascination with how things worked on the ISS. Of course, I had studied the spacecraft. I even worked on one of the modules as a subcontractor to one of the big aerospace firms in my late graduate school years. But there is no substitute for actually being there. I asked about the space shuttle ride and if she ever got sick. She said that she never did. I'm sure this was a lie. Doesn't everybody get sick the first time? I asked when she planned to go up again, and her response was very political.
I just want to do what's best for the program, she replied.
I guess astronauts have to be good-natured and careful about what they say around everyone. Things have definitely changed from the old who's the best pilot you ever saw Mercury astronaut days. I did find out one thing about astronauts. They're not, or at least Colonel Ames is not, particularly good at chess. Mid-flight, I beat her hands down 3 games in a row, and one of those with a fool's mate. Then again, all those hours I spent playing my laptop chess, she was practicing how to land the space shuttle, and I sure wish I could trade. The flight attendant was gently shaking my shoulder. I didn't even realize that I was asleep. God, we had already landed in Baltimore and were at the gate. When did Colonel Ames leave, and when did I stop talking to her? Who turned off my laptop? Beer and painkillers. Don't mix them. The flight attendant helped me with my overhead bag, and I headed for a very crowded rental car counter. Thank God for all the air miles I had that made me a gold medallion customer, which enabled me to go to the front of the line. Then I had to catch a shuttle from the rental car desk to the rental car parking lot. The trip to the hotel was typical. I took Interstate 95 down to Highway 1. The parkway was bumper to bumper, and it took 30 minutes to get off 1 and onto the green belt where my hotel was. By the time I got checked into the hotel, I was beat. I tried to rehearse my view graphs, but after about 3 of them, I said screw it and went to bed. The alarm clock scared the living daylights out of me. I was so tired, I don't even remember dreaming. I hate nights like that. Since I sleep on my back, I tried to raise myself sit-up style. Nothing doing. My ribs were still causing me a lot of pain. I broke my hand once when I was a teenager. It seemed to take about a week before the really big pain subsided to a dull ache. I still get a dull ache in it just before it rains, and it's been over 23 years. It must have something to do with the low-pressure systems usually accompanied by rain. I've asked physicians about that before. They always laugh and say it's in my head. There's enough crazy stuff in my head. Why would I put that in there, too? Stupid alchemists. Anyway, I had to tuck my left hand over my ribs and hold myself tightly. Then I rolled over, counterclockwise, and sort of fell out of bed. Getting shaved, showered, and dressed was just as tough, and I said many bad words that my great Aunt Meg would have been proud of. The Breakthrough Physics Propulsion Workshop, or BPP workshop, was held in an auditorium-sized room. The start of the meeting was fairly standard for a technical conference. The director of the conference said a few words and corrected a few scheduling mistakes. One in particular caught my attention. Our guest speaker and new director of the BPP, Colonel Tabitha Ames, has requested to be moved from first speaker this morning to last, so make a note of that. Let's get started, then. This change makes the first speaker this morning Dr. Anson Clemens from Metric Engineering Incorporated. Dr. Clemens is also a faculty member of the Physics Department at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and he is a member of the National Space Science and Technology Center, or NSSTC, as it has come to be known. Dr. Clemens? It was a damn good thing I wasn't late. I slowly moved up to the front of the auditorium and handed a CD with my slideshow to the audio-visual person. I fiddled around with the clip-on microphone for a minute or so, then got comfortable with the slideshow remote laser pointer. Clearing my throat, I began. Hello, I'm Anson Clemens, as you were just told, and I plan to talk to you today about the status of space-time metric engineering and how close we are to demonstrating faster-than-light space travel. Of course, everybody realizes that we can't go faster than the speed of light in the vacuum, but as Miguel Alcubierre showed us in 1994, it is possible to effectively create a region of space-time that's warped in such a way that the vacuum speed of light is increased tremendously. So, instead of the vacuum speed of light being 1, assume it can be increased to 1,000. This means that a spacecraft could possibly travel at hundreds of times faster than the vacuum speed of light and never notice any special relativistic effects. No time dilation, space-time contraction, nothing. Alcubierre himself stated up front in the abstract of that wonderful 1994 paper in Classical and Quantum Gravity that in order to accomplish this warp bubble, that a tremendous amount of exotic matter would be required. Of course, we all know that the exotic matter implies negative energy, and the number of papers supporting, opposing, or correcting the Alcubierre warp theory absolutely snowballed over the next decade. I know that many of us here in this room are guilty of riding several of them. I gave a quick, guilty smile and harumphed in response to the chuckles coming from the audience.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?